And the Savior says, ye have heard that it was said by them of old time, thou shalt not kill, and whosoever shall kill shall be in danger of the judgment. But I say unto you that whosoever is angry with his brother without a cause, shall be in danger of the judgment. And whosoever shall say to his brother, Raca, vain fellow, margin, shall be in danger of the council. But whosoever shall say, thou fool, shall be in danger of hellfire. Matthew 5, 21 and 22. The Apostle John, referring to the same thing, says, whosoever hateth his brother is murderer. 1 John 3, 15. Again, the Savior says, ye have heard that it was said by them of old time, thou shalt not commit adultery. But I say unto you that whosoever looketh on a woman to lust after her, hath committed adultery with her already in his heart. Matthew 5, 27 and 28. Other illustrations might be given, but these are sufficient to show that obedience to the moral law is morality, that it pertains to the thoughts and intents of the heart, and therefore, in the very nature of the case, lies beyond the reach or control of the civil power. To hate is murder. To covet is idolatry. To think impurely of a woman is adultery. These are all equally immoral, and violations of the moral law, but no civil government seeks to punish for them. A man may hate his neighbor all his life. He may covet everything on earth. He may think impurely of every woman that he sees. He may keep it up all his days. But so long as these things are confined to his thought, the civil power cannot touch him. It would be difficult to conceive of a more immoral person than such a man would be. Yet the state cannot punish him. It does not attempt to punish him. This demonstrates again that with morality or immorality the state can have nothing to do. But let us carry this further. Only let that man's hatred lead him, either by word or sign, to attempt an injury to his neighbor, and the state will punish him. Only let his covetousness lead him to lay hands on what is not his own, in an attempt to steal, and the state will punish him. Only let his impure thought lead him to attempt violence to any woman, and the state will punish him. Yet bear in mind that even then the state does not punish him for his immorality, but for his incivility. The immorality lies in the heart, and can be measured by God only. The state punishes no man because he is immoral. If it did, it would have to punish as a murderer the man who hates another, and to punish as an idolater the man who covets, and to punish as an adulterer the one who thinks impurely. Because according to the true standard of morality, hatred is murder, covetousness is idolatry, and impurity of thought is adultery. Therefore it is clear that, in fact, the state punishes no man because he is immoral, but because he is uncivil. It cannot punish immorality. It must punish incivility. This distinction is shown in the very term by which is designated state or national government. It is called civil government. No person but a theocrat ever thinks of calling it moral government. The government of God is the only moral government. God is the only moral governor. The law of God is the only moral law. To God alone pertains the punishment of immorality, which is the transgression of the moral law. Governments of men are civil governments, not moral. The laws of states and nations are civil laws, not moral. To the authorities of civil government pertains the punishment of incivility, that is, the transgression of civil law. It is not theirs to punish immorality. That pertains solely to the author of the moral law and of the moral sense, who is the sole judge of man's moral relation. All this must be manifest to everyone who will think fairly upon the subject, and it is confirmed by the definition of the word civil, which is this: civil, pertaining to a city or state, or to a citizen and his relations to his fellow citizens, or to the state. Thus it is made clear that we owe to Caesar civil government only that which is civil, and that we owe to God that which is moral or religious, and that to no man, to no assembly or organization of men, does there belong any right whatever to punish immorality. Whoever attempts it, usurps the prerogative of God. The Inquisition is the inevitable logic of any claim of any assembly of men to punish immorality, because to punish immorality, it is necessary in some way to get at the thoughts and intents of the heart. The papacy, asserting the right to compel men to be moral, and to punish them for immorality, had the cruel courage to carry the evil principle to its logical consequence. In carrying out the principle, it was found to be essential to get at the secrets of men's hearts. And it was found that the diligent application of torture would wring from men, in many cases, a full confession of the most secret counsels of their hearts. Hence the Inquisition was established as the means best adapted to secure the desired end. So long as men grant the proposition that it is within the province of civil government to enforce morality, it is to very little purpose that they condemn the Inquisition. For that tribunal is only the logical result of the proposition. Thus much on the subject of morality in the state in the true and genuine sense of the word morality. But, as I said at the beginning, there is an accommodated sense in which the word morality is used, in which it is made to refer only to men's relations to their fellow men. And with reference to this view of morality, it is sometimes said that the civil power is to enforce morality upon a civil basis. But morality on a civil basis is only civility, and the enforcement of morality upon a civil basis is the enforcement of civility, and nothing else. Without the Inquisition, it is impossible for civil government ever to carry its jurisdiction beyond civil things, or to enforce anything but civility. But it may be asked, does not the civil power enforce the observance of the commandments of God, which say, Thou shalt not steal, thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not commit adultery, and thou shalt not bear false witness? Does not the civil power punish the violation of these commandments of God? I answer, the civil power does not enforce these, nor does it punish the violation of them, as commandments of God. The state does forbid murder and theft and perjury, and some states forbid adultery, but not as commandments of God. From time immemorial, governments that knew nothing about God have forbidden these things. If the state is to enforce these things as the commandments of God, it will have to take cognizance of the thoughts and intents of the heart. But this is not within the province of any earthly power. By all these evidences is established the plain, common sense principle that, to civil government pertains only that which the term itself implies, that which is civil. The purpose of civil government is civil, and not moral. Its function is to preserve order in society, and to cause all its subjects to rest in assured safety, by guarding them against all incivility. Morality belongs to God. Civility to the state. Morality must be rendered to God. Civility to the state. Immorality must be punished, can be punished, only by the Lord. Incivility must be punished, and no more than that can possibly be punished, by the state. Here then, at the close of my remarks, we are brought to the enunciation of the eternal principle with which I began, upon which we now stand, and upon which we forever expect to stand, the principle embodied in the United States Constitution forbidding religious tests, and forbidding Congress to make any law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, the principle established by Jesus Christ, render therefore unto Caesar the things which are Caesar's, and unto God, the things that are God's.
Mr. Chairman, the objection raised by Professor Jones against the exemption in favor of Sabbath keepers seems to me wholly imaginary. So far as any Seventh-day Baptists are concerned, I know it would be impossible for any man opening a saloon on Sunday to present the excuse that he was a Seventh-day Baptist. A saloon-keeping Seventh-day Baptist is an unknown thing throughout the history of more than two centuries. Such a man could not obtain recognition, much less church membership in any Seventh-day Baptist community or church. Nor do I believe, from what I know of the Seventh-day Adventists, that such a case could occur in connection with that people. The possibility of any such deceitful claim could easily be guarded against by a provision requiring that in any case of doubt the one claiming to have observed the seventh day should be required to bring official certificate of his relation to a Sabbath-keeping church. Such a provision would end all difficulty,